I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. WYPR reporter Kenneth Burns updates us on this first week of the trial of Baltimore police officer William Porter. Then, an East Baltimore neighborhood calls for an end to violent crime. We hear from an organizer about the community's grief and frustration. Plus, the CDC reports a drop in the number of Americans newly diagnosed with diabetes. We talk to a doctor about next steps. And we catch up on business headlines from the Port of Baltimore to McCormick Spice Company and look at whether April's unrest made an impact on hiring in the city. And someone from the Charm City Craft Mafia gives us a heads up about a holiday market. All on Midday after headlines from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. Very glad that you are with us today. Later in today's news roundup, we'll discuss some well-received health news. New cases of diabetes in the U.S. are on the decline for the first time in about two decades. Diabetes researcher Dr. David M. Nathan will give us details about the success and tell us why we shouldn't celebrate much yet. Also, Rick Seltzer from the Baltimore Business Journal will join us again for an update on business news. But first, it is the end of the first week in the trial of William G. Porter, Officer William G. Porter of the Baltimore Police Department, one of the six officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray. Porter is the first to go on trial. The trial is continuing this morning with the testimony of Sarita Teal, the lead detective investigating this case, and WYPR's P. Kenneth Burns is covering the trial. He joins us from outside the courthouse. Kenny, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Kenny. I'm hearing the echo that you've got that you're working with, so I will try to speak a little more slowly than usual and give you time to answer me. And my question really is pretty simple to start with. What have we seen from the prosecution thus far?
Sheila, in the last hour, we have seen the video statement from Officer William Porter. The last time we saw this video in particular, it was just part of it, just the part where he waves.
Oh, dear. I think we have lost Kenny. I'll tell you what. We will try to get Kenny back on the line because I would like to know what's going on. I'm sure you would, too, what's going on today in the Porter trial. But we have with us another guest, sort of a related topic. I mean, the trial certainly deals with the sentiment in Baltimore, the connection between the community and the police, the sometimes the frustration, and of course frustration about the murder rate, the crime, the violent crime in Baltimore. And there is a neighborhood in East Baltimore that's trying to do something about it. Tonight, members of East Baltimore's Oliver neighborhood have organized a rally calling for peace in our streets. That event will begin at the corner of the 1200 block of Caroline and Preston Streets at 5:30 p.m. And one of the event's organizers, Marcus Dent, is with me here in Studio A. Well, welcome to Midday, Marcus.
Thank you. Thank you.
So tell us about this event tonight.
Well, today we just want to bring together East, West, North, South, everyone from the city to really try to address this issue. We have a lot of young black males. I'm a young black male who have been victims of violence. Far too often, these cases go unsolved. So we got to rebuild our relationships with our uniformed officers, get them out of their cars, into the streets, talking to the community members so we can get some of these things tackled. Our goal for today is not just to march, not just to give speeches. We want to come out of this with tangible action items. Hey, we want to get into our school systems. We want to get more services for our seniors. We want to get more things out here as far as job placements for our young people as well, so that we can help positively affect this crime rate, because it's getting absolutely out of hand.
I think a lot of people would agree with you that it's out of hand. Tell me specifically the logistics. You say this isn't to be just a march, but part of it is. So you're meeting at 5:30.
Yeah.
And then what?
Yes, we'll meet at 5:30 at Caroline and Preston Street. We'll talk a little bit for maybe 15 to 20 minutes, and then we'll march down to Madison Street and come all the way back up through Eden Street. and back around the other side on Carolina Street. And we'll stop at some of the places where some of our folks have actually fallen over the past year or so.
And as I understand it, this is being put together by a real coalition of quite a few groups.
Yes.
Tell me what went into putting this networking together.
We had a close friend, Gregory Mungo, a single father, really good guy, close friend of mine, who actually was shot in the head in his car on Tuesday. And that just sent shockwaves just across the city because Greg was well-loved. And we said, we have to do something now. We can't wait. We can't wait. We got to do something now. So we called out to every group that we could find and said, hey, come participate. This is not about one particular group or one particular neighborhood. This is about an entire city. So we contacted Stokey Kennedy. So the Stokey Project will be there. Safe Streets will be there. Myself, Gary Crum, Kirsten Allen, Kwame Rose, a lot of folks. Just coming out, regardless of where you live, this is a problem that's universal here in Baltimore City that we have to address.
Why does it feel you grew up in Northeast Baltimore,
yes,
right?
And yes.
You're a veteran of the Air Force. You run a local IT program delivering educational needs together, DEMT.
Yes.
What kind of impact? I mean, as I look at the zip codes for the Oliver neighborhood, 21201, 21213. The Baltimore Sun's ongoing data about where homicides are occurring indicates 37 murders of the 316 murders Baltimore had, 37 in your neighborhood. So what kind of impact is that having?
You know, in the Oliver community, it's roughly about 10%. Mm. That's a big number. That's a very big number. And if you look citywide, if you can go a little further, even to Northeast Baltimore, 21218, 21214, 21234, it's the same thing. You'll see another 8 to 9% as far as that murder rate there. So you can't just say it's one community. It's really a lot of different communities. That's why we had to bring everyone together. And you mentioned my military background. Strategically, we can't get this done by just focusing our own small little pockets. We have to come together collectively and really get a conversation going so we can have these action items.
You talked about some of your goals mm-hmm. for this event. Some people are listening to this and saying, oh, come on, a march. I mean, really. People listening, sympathetic that this is a huge problem, skeptical that there's any way to approach it.
You know, it's not, like I said, it's not just a march. We're going to come away with this with some action items. Hey, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to do this, you have to do that. I don't have all those answers right now, but I plan to have them by the end of today. That's my goal, to say, hey, this is what we're going to do over the next 10 days, 20 days, 30 days, so we can actually see some results, because that's what it's about. We need results. We have to stop letting violence come into our communities and negatively affect the way that our neighbors and our residents are living.
And you just said you don't have all the answers, but obviously people have been worrying about this for a while. Mm-hmm. People have been trying to make a difference. What is there an element you can point to with what you know now that you think has been missing that the community could supply?
Well, right now you mentioned my DEMT program, Delivering Educational Needs Together. I've tried to tackle that critical job element, getting some of our folks who are recently incarcerated, teaching them IT and getting them back to work, because if you're working, then you're not out committing crimes. If you're not out committing crimes, then you won't be subjected, you most likely won't be subjected to any violence, and you won't be an assailant either. So that was my small effort. But like I said, it's a lot of different efforts that are out there. We got to put all the pieces of the puzzle together so these efforts can be combined. Once that happens, then we'll see some true change.
Marcus, I really appreciate your talking to us. I'm going to ask you to sit here with me. We think we have Kenny Burns back on the line to give us an update of the trial. Kenny, you with us?
I'm here.
That's great. Yeah, I still hear the echo. So try again. You were telling me what the prosecution presented this morning.
Well, and I apologize. It's the acoustics in the room as far as the echo goes.
Gotcha.
As far as this morning, Detective Sarita Teal, the lead detective, returned to the stand, and we actually saw the video statement that Officer Porter gave to Detective Teal and another detective. He discussed the incident, what happened from his perspective. He described what he said to Freddie Gray as he was doing the prisoner check at the fourth stop. And it was actually, if I could jump ahead a little bit, when the van returned to the Western District Police Station, it was Officer Porter who looked in the van, saw Gray's condition, and just said that a medic needed to be called.
So basically what you're describing is Officer Porter's statement to police investigators. We haven't seen Officer Porter on the stand himself.
Not yet. We actually saw a little preview of this video during pretrial motions in September. The only part that we saw at that time was Officer Porter waiving his Miranda rights and his rights as a law enforcement officer. That's your, you'll hear the jargon, Leo Board. That's Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. But today we saw the full video. It lasted about an hour. And this interview was conducted by the now former investigative team that has since been dismantled and remodeled under a different term. Detective Teal is now in the Internal Affairs Division. That's a little inside baseball. But at the time, it was the FIT team that was investigating what happened once Gray returned to the police station onward.
Okay, so this was how Officer Porter was describing what happened to investigators. This would have been a statement he made before he was charged.
Yes.
And with everything that you know about the sequence, it's been described a lot, and you're covering this case closely. Were there things in his statement, or other things in Detective Teal's testimony, that gave you some new insight into how things unfolded that morning in April?
Well, the video gives a little bit more of what happened that day compared to what has already been reported on our station and elsewhere. We've gotten a little bit more of Porter's view and as far as what he did during the prisoner check, what happened at two other stops where Porter was. This included the second stop where they took him out of the van to tie his legs before putting him back in. And we also saw a little bit of the interaction with Officer Porter and Sergeant Alicia White, who stands trial early next year for her alleged role in this incident. Porter said that Sergeant Wright told him to follow the wagon back to the police station after she did a prisoner check.
So was the implication, as you heard that, was the implication that you picked up that he felt it wasn't his responsibility? I'm not quite sure what to draw, if any, conclusion from the point you just made.
Well, just know overall that Porter has seen Gray arrested before. He recalls him making a scene when he was arrested, and in one instance in particular, he tried to kick out the windows of a squad car after he was placed in. So he knows Porter. I mean, Porter knows Gray from patrolling the Western District on a regular basis. So there's a little bit of history there, but not really the – but I shouldn't say not really, but the two have a history.
Okay. And focusing on Detective Sarita Teal's testimony, was there anything you picked up from what she has – she started testifying yesterday, continued this morning. Did her description give you any new insight into, again, how things unfolded?
Once again, we received a little bit more detail in regards to how the beginnings of the investigation, the actions she took when she was called to Western District to begin the investigation. This was her second or third case as the lead detective on a FIT investigation. Actually, Don't quote me on that, but she's
Kenny, you're live on radio. People are listening.
I know. I thought I had that page out, but in any case, she responded to Western District to begin the investigation. She checked on Freddie Gray at the hospital that he was taken to, and then returned to the Western District, and later returned to, well, went to the scene of the arrest to begin the investigation, the search for witnesses, and the search for evidence.
So do you know what else we're going to hear from the prosecution, what other testimony they intend to present, and when we would hear from the defense?
Well, the questioning by the prosecution is continuing right now, and the defense has not had a chance to cross-examine Detective Teal. That is coming up at some point. It might be, depending on how long the prosecution goes at this time, the cross-examination might begin after lunch.
Okay. And will there be more testimony presented by the prosecution before, and when do you think we'll get to the defense?
Well, keep in mind, we still have not heard in detail about the autopsy that was conducted on Freddie Gray. We haven't heard as far as the injuries obtained while he was in custody. Remember, he was described as being able to stand and move before he was placed into the police van and the medical once they arrived to the Western District. So we still have a little bit more testimony to get through before we see the defense.
Well, Kenny, I really appreciate your bringing us up to date. I want to let you get back to the trial, so I thank you. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Marcus Dent, I also thank you for you telling us about what the Oliver community is going to be doing. Again, the march, which you say will be more than a march, starts at 5:30 tonight at the corner of Caroline and Preston Streets, correct?
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a break now. When we come back, we have some good health news to talk about. Apparently, a significant slowdown in new cases of diabetes, and more ahead in the show. So stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We have a chance now to talk about some good news on a health topic in contrast to some of the health developments we've been covering recently. The Centers for Disease Control published data this week that the number of new cases of diabetes in adults has dropped. New cases fell by about one-fifth between 2008 and 2014 last year. This drop follows a dozen years of increases in the number of people diagnosed with diabetes. Dr. David Nathan is director of the Diabetes Center and Clinical Research Center at Massachusetts General Hospital, and he joins us by phone to give us some more details about this development. Dr. Nathan, welcome to Midday.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sure. So a drop in new diagnosis of about one-fifth over those 6 years. How significant is this?
Well, it's both significant in terms of the numbers, but it also looks like it's a very consistent finding over the past about 6 to 7 years. So just by way of background, there has been this diabetes epidemic that I think everyone now knows about has been going on since the mid-1970s or so, and it's really represented an increase in diabetes every year, a 5% increase in the new cases. And this was going up and up and up until it hit about almost 2 million people a year as of about 6 or 8 years ago. The most recent results show that there's been a further decline over the last 6 years or so, so that instead of being about a 5% increase each and every year, it now looks like it's not only flat, but that the numbers are starting to decrease. So this is really very welcome news in the setting of an epidemic that has really captured all of our attention and really represents one of the major public health issues that we're dealing with.
Right.
The total numbers go down from about 1.7 million new cases a year, which was about 5 or 6 years ago, down to about 1.4 million new cases per year.
And, I mean, as you said, this has been an epidemic. And take just a minute to tell us what the implications for an individual with diabetes are. What happens when you have diabetes, or what can happen?
Right. So diabetes is both, I think, the sixth or seventh most common cause of death in this country and in much of the world. The major problems with diabetes is just not, you know, that your sugar is elevated. I mean, everyone knows about the sugar being high. But that over a long period of time, people with diabetes are very vulnerable to having vision problems and amputations, kidney failure. So the diabetes in the U.S., for example, is the single greatest cause of loss of vision in adults. It's the single greatest cause of amputations. It's the single greatest cause of renal failure, kidney failure, and dialysis or transplantation. And it also increases the risk of heart attack and stroke by something like 2 to 4-fold. So diabetes is one of these long-term degenerative diseases that really has a major impact on the people who develop it.
And what then, in your view, is behind this decline in new cases?
Well, you know, I can't say that we understand it absolutely. What we do know is that what's behind the epidemic is the co-epidemic of overweight and obesity, and that the entire country, and in fact the entire world, is getting more sedentary. That is, that they don't, you know, when we go to work, we used to go to work 100 years ago, and you working meant sweating, it meant farming, it meant manufacturing with our hands. Now, with the electronic age and with computers, most of us spend most of our time sitting on our duffs and not being as active. And this has contributed to this epidemic of obesity.
Is that changing?
If you look at the epidemic of diabetes, it parallels exactly this epidemic of obesity over time.
And
so we think that's behind it.
That we're not as sedentary as we were a few years ago.
That we're very sedentary, we have been very sedentary, and what explains the turnaround is probably that I think the population has finally decided to take this kind of lifestyle, which is really kind of toxic, not being mm-hmm. very active, overeating, gaining more weight as we get older. And I think we're starting to take those risk factors quite seriously. There was a study called the Diabetes Prevention Program, which was supported by the National Institutes of Health, that ended in 2002. And that study showed that we could decrease the development of diabetes by 58% just by having people lose just about 10, 15 pounds of weight and trying to keep that weight off, and by increasing their walking on a regular basis. So, that was in 2002. After that happened, there have been numerous programs run by the VA, programs that are offered through YMCAs, programs through state agencies that have all emphasized this diabetes prevention program. And I can only hope that some of those lessons are permeating, and that explains maybe why we're starting to see this downturn in diabetes.
The New York Times quoted you saying, "This is not yet time to have a parade," close quote. In other words, not too much celebration yet. Why? Elaborate on that.
It would be a good idea to have a parade if everyone got out and walked. I mean, that would be a good time to have a parade if we did it every day. But the reason I say I was cautious about this is because, let's face it, although we have decreased the rate by a fifth, there are still, 1.4 million new cases a year. It's not as if we've stopped it. But we have decreased the increase in new cases of diabetes. So that is good news. I mean, this is good news in the midst of what's only been really worse and worsening news over time. We probably have had this downturn in the U.S., have hit a peak, and now maybe it's turning downward. But keep in mind that in other places in the world with huge populations, China and India and places in Africa, where the lifestyle has really changed much more dramatically than it has in the U.S. So, for example, in countries with huge populations where the populations really are moving from farming or farms into the city, the rate of diabetes increase is still doubling every few years. So, we may have hit our peak, but the rest of the world it hasn't hit that peak. They're still going up.
Well, and let me ask you to bore a little more deeply into the U.S. numbers about how widespread they are. I mean, who is it? What groups are seeing a drop in new diagnosis of diabetes, well, and what groups aren't.
Right. So the first thing is to keep in mind who is at risk for type 2 diabetes. And the answer is almost everyone. The estimates were, as of a few years ago, that over the course of their lifespan, one in every three people born in the, you know, beyond the year 2000 would develop diabetes. But within that, within the U.S. population, men and women are pretty similarly affected, but there are certain ethnic and racial groups that are even more at risk than others. So, for example, African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, and American Indians are all at substantially higher risk than Caucasians in this.
And do we see in what do we see from them in the new numbers, or are the numbers not broken down?
It is broken down, and it's broken down by age as well, because people who are older also are at greater risk. And the benefits are being seen pretty much uniformly across those groups, but some groups have benefited more and some groups have benefited less recently. So, for example, overweight African-American women have not had the same kind of benefit as have overweight Caucasian women. Mm-hmm. And that may represent, you know, that the message hasn't permeated into every nook and cranny of the U.S. population. It may also be that there are different genetic risks in different groups, and so that it's harder work for some groups to avoid diabetes than others.
You mentioned type 2 diabetes, and I saw that the CDC numbers cover ages 18 to 79. Does that mean that these numbers don't really reflect what we used to call juvenile diabetes?
Well, it does reflect a little bit of it. What we used to call juvenile diabetes was called that because it develops for the most part during childhood and adolescence, and that's now called type 1 diabetes. It used to be called juvenile onset. It turns out that that type of diabetes represents a tiny fraction. So type 2 diabetes, which is the epidemic form, if you will, which occurs mostly in adults, you know, that is the one that's been going up and up and up over time and has now taken a little bit of a downward turn. But that represents something like 95% of all diabetes. So type 1 is relatively rare, and type 2 is much more common.
Let me ask you about another element of concern for people with diabetes, and that is the cost of prescriptions, specifically insulin. Do you see many patients who are not able to afford their insulin prescriptions?
Well, I'm glad you asked the question, because it's kind of a crime what's going on. One thing is that the pharmaceutical industry has been both clever and resourceful in developing lots of new drugs to treat both type 1 diabetes, mostly different forms of insulin that are quite helpful, and type 2 diabetes, which, you know, can respond to a variety of different pills. However, the cost of those medicines has just been increasing at an astronomical rate. And that includes even old medicines. So insulin and some of the forms of insulin have been around for 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years and haven't changed at all in terms of their composition or their manufacturing. And yet the cost has gone up by twofold, fourfold, fivefold over time. And it's as if competition is not working in the pharmaceutical marketplace. It's not as if the idea that a free market will result in lower drugs. If anything, the drugs just keep going up step by step. Each drug, one drug company raises its prices, and the next day another drug company raises its prices. And it's really unfortunate. And it's something, by the way, that goes on somewhat uniquely in the United States. In Europe and in Canada, the governments actually negotiate the prices of medicines. They're not left, you know, just to be drifting along. In the U.S., kind of the charges are basically what the market will bear. And as a result, there are people who are now no longer able to afford their medicine, including insulin sometimes.
And does our government offer any backup in that case? I mean, are there actually without diabetes medication?
Well, right. I mean, so there are all kinds of programs, and the pharmaceutical industry has put into place, you know, if you can't afford it, they will try to make sure that they have some way of getting you the insulin. But that's not a great fallback. I mean, these drugs should be affordable and available to everyone. What most patients see, of course, is just their copay. So they may see that they're using a drug now which has a copay of $20 a month instead of $10. And by the way, that can be quite painful financially. But some of those drugs are actually costing someone $300 a month or $400 a month or even more. And that is costing the entire system tremendously.
several of the articles I read about this stressed the difference between incidence of diabetes, the new cases, and prevalence.
Right.
People living with diabetes. I saw a number, which I don't have in front of me, of how many million Americans are living with diabetes. So I guess what is the message here? How fragile is this turning point we're talking about when we're talking about, as you mentioned earlier, we're still 1.4 million people newly diagnosed last year with
right.
diabetes.
Right. So incidence is the rate of development each year. So you develop X number of people on an annual basis, and that can go up or down. Diabetes does not kill people. It's not an acutely fatal disease, so people will end up living with their diabetes for many years. So all the time with this new population entering the diabetes pool, if you will, that increases the prevalence, and prevalence represents the percentage of the population that has diabetes at any one time. The number of people in the U.S. with diabetes is somewhere approaching 30 million people. So it's a lot of folks. And that number has been increasing also over time because the annual rate has been going up. But now that's starting to slow down as well. So the number of that's expected to develop diabetes in the U.S. Over the next 15 years may go from 30 million to 35 million. Now, remember, the population, of course, is growing as well.
Mm-hmm.
Worldwide, there are about 400 million people with diabetes, and that number is expected to reach about 600 million in the next 15 years or so. So we're talking about large numbers. The other good news, I mean, not only that we're starting to be able to prevent it a little bit better than we have in the past, but the other good news, frankly, is that we also know how to treat it much better than we have in the past. So that people with diabetes, it's better not to have it than to have it. But if you develop diabetes, we have better ways of preventing you people from losing their vision or having kidney failure. We can prevent its complications, but it takes a lot of work and it's expensive to do. It involves control of your blood sugar levels. It involves control of blood pressure and cholesterol. So it's complicated therapy. Again, better not to have it, but if you do have it, you and patients with diabetes and their healthcare providers can help ensure that they're going to have, hopefully, a pretty full life.
Dr. Nathan, I really appreciate your sharing us a story that is, on balance, more good news than not. So, we don't get to do that often. So, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Dr. David Nathan is director of the Diabetes Center and Clinical Research Center at Massachusetts General Hospital. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, business headlines with Rick Seltzer of the Baltimore Business Journal, and a local artist gives us a preview of an upcoming holiday market in Baltimore. Stay with us for that. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm here in the studio. I've got a very talented crafter across me in the studio. But first, we're going to catch up on some business headlines. Yesterday, the Port of Baltimore announced a 30-year contract with its biggest customer, a Norwegian company that specializes in shipping heavy machinery and automobiles. And Rick Seltzer of the Baltimore Business Journal is here to talk about that and some other stories. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So this company, I felt deeply ignorant when I read your piece, Wallenius Wilhelmsen.
Wilhelmsen,
which is based in Norway. I never heard of them, and it's a huge company. So tell us who they are.
It's funny. A lot of shipping companies are that way. Earlier this year, the Port of Baltimore had a deal with container shipper Maersk, and you have to look up how to say them and remember how to say them because they're really not consumer facing in many ways.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this is a very large company that. Here at the Port of Baltimore, predominantly does automobiles and then really heavy construction and farm equipment shipping. That's things like your combines or large irrigators. Or yesterday they rolled out a piece of equipment that's used to harvest trees. Some of this really big, really important things for the Port of Baltimore. The Port of Baltimore is the biggest automobile shipper in the country. That's mm-hmm. that's its calling card right now. And this shipping company is responsible for about a third of all of the cars that moved through the port last year. It is a huge operation. It is a huge part of the port's business. So this 30-year deal, it actually was renewed early, if you will. The port has had a 20-year deal in place that started in 2001 with WWL, mm-hmm. Which is what I'll call Wilenius Wilhelmsen, so we don't trip over it. And so they had about six more years to renew this. And ended up doing a 30-year deal that runs through 2045.
And you quoted an officer of the company saying, we're going to be big at the Port of Baltimore even more than 30 years. I mean, it's not as if they feel constrained to tough out 30 years at the Port of Baltimore.
That's right. They right now they have about between 900 and 1,000 jobs that they're directly responsible for in one way or another. They have several different arms of the company there. They do more than just put the stuff on ships. They actually treat the cars, get them ready for either shipment overseas. They just built a new 25,000 square foot. It looks like a hangar almost. And that's where they prepare the cars to go to Australia and New Zealand, prep them so stink bugs don't ride over there and devastate agriculture over there. And then they also prep cars for dealer lots. They'll bolt on the spoilers or put in stereos after they come from overseas and before they go to be sold to the consumer here. There's a lot of processing, a lot more than just roll it on and roll it off that goes on with WWL.
And another reason your story is interesting is it points to business at the port having been pretty good this past year.
That's right. I think the previous, it was 2014 or the full year numbers that we have at this point, and it was a record year for automobile shipments. I believe it was also a record year for, or close to a record year for the roll-on, roll-off cargo. That's those heavy equipment that we talk about. The cars, it's about 790,000 cars that rolled off last year. MPA's executive director, Jim White, told me they're possibly going to hit 800,000 this year. That's been a goal for a while, and I think that'd be pretty exciting for them. It's helped in part by the fact that the automobile industry is selling really well. Domestically, it's selling at record levels, and I think it's doing fairly well in other parts of the country as well. So that really gives a boost.
And they are, the port is trying to make it easier for large trucks to get in and around the port with replacing the Colgate Creek Bridge?
That's right. That's a city project that I believe was announced a few weeks ago. There's a lot of infrastructure that goes into getting in and out of the port. You may remember double stack rail was an issue for cargo containers. It remains an issue. That one hasn't been resolved. But this bridge that the city said we're going to replace a few weeks ago had been structurally deficient, I believe, or maybe even structurally decrepit. The largest trucks couldn't roll over it. It had them routed around, adding time when they were trying to get to the port. That's not going to be your automobile traffic. That's container traffic, which is another important element the port's trying to build on. Mm-hmm. But overall, this is a port that I think you hear a lot about lately with upkeep and adding to the connections to it so that shippers can get their goods in and out of Baltimore.
So you reported on jobs from Wilenius Wilhelmsen, 1,000 direct jobs, maybe 1,500 indirect jobs because of them. And speaking of jobs, you wrote a story about hiring in Baltimore, looking at state employment figures and research from a job market analytics firm, and found that the problems in April, the unrest and the riot had what you used the phrase small dent in the numbers.
Yeah, it's interesting. Depending on who you talk to, you get very different stories when you ask the question, have you had trouble recruiting since April? And the basic genesis for this story was we wanted to ask the companies that are likely to be hiring from out of the area that are going to need to recruit maybe a high-level technical position, need to fill it now, get it in there, and see if that kind of recruitment has taken a hit. If people saw coverage of the events of April and started asking, should we move to Baltimore? You talk to the major employers, your Under Armours, your Johns Hopkins, and they're saying, no, we haven't felt anything, which to a certain degree you might expect. And to a certain degree, you all often wonder if that's just the answer that everyone gives to the question.
To the press, yeah.
So then we went and we took it and we took this job market analytics firm and brought them in. And they found that there is a change in recruiting. The average time to fill a position of job postings in the Baltimore market, it increased by 32% from the third quarter of 2014 to the third quarter of 2015. That's a pretty big jump. That's 37 days that a position would be posted, up to 49 days is the increase there. Mm-hmm. They also found that salaries, that companies had to offer increased faster than the national rate. That indicates that it became harder to recruit in Baltimore. It doesn't indicate a why, though. There are a number of other reasons that could go into it. Frankly, it's a better market for job seekers today than it was a year
ago.
Yeah,
so you would expect some of those effects.
Correct. So you would expect some of that, and we don't really know how much. Depending which company you talk to, they'll tell you different things. Recruiters did tell me, unlike those larger employers, several recruiters did tell me, yeah, we felt an effect. Some people said it still exists for people who are considering going downtown, that there's an extra question maybe that gets asked about safety and security. And others told me that there was an immediate impact, and I think this is what you were referencing earlier. There was an immediate impact in maybe the month or two after the riot in April, but then it faded away.
Yeah, you quoted one of the recruiters saying we're kind of back to where we were. I mean, there have always been some questions that recruiters need to deal with, and at least one person told you they're kind of back to where they were.
That is the other issue that kept coming up. Is frankly, just because you get job seekers who are asking about Baltimore's safety. Just because you get those people today does not mean that's a change from April or pre-April. A lot of people were asking these questions before because they've seen the wire. When I moved here from Indiana 2 years ago, frankly, someone referenced the wire to me when I said where I was moving to take this job. So it's something that's going to be part of the conversation about working in Baltimore, whether or whether not the riots come into it.
Before I lose all my time with you, I want to ask, there's a couple other stories that were interesting, but in particular, one that I didn't see coming, Amazon announcing they're going to be moving into the food delivery business, which is, I've been reading the stuff about Amazon thinking of doing product delivery by drone.
I didn't
realize they were going to be competing with, you know, local restaurants.
It's not just food delivery, it's restaurant delivery,
Restaurant
too.
Delivery.
And of course, this is interesting for a number of different reasons. First of all, Baltimore has a company that's homegrown that does restaurant delivery. It's OrderUp. And they're in the Can Company over in Canton. They're based, and they've grown. They were sold to Groupon this summer for a pretty lucrative deal. So it's interesting that Amazon comes into this market, really, into OrderUp's home turf.
Uh-huh.
And Baltimore's only the fourth city that Amazon's moved into with this service. They started in Seattle in September, I believe, and then Portland and Los Angeles were added. So Baltimore's up there with some West Coast cities as one of the first things that gets this. So there's a couple other reasons it's interesting, too. Operationally, I find it fascinating, and don't go to sleep on me here. But basically, Amazon launched their Prime Now delivery service a little while ago in Baltimore.
Prime Now is different than Prime.
Correct. Prime Now is they'll ship you certain items within an hour or two.
Oh, okay. Now.
Okay. So, exactly.
Hence the now.
It is the rapid delivery system.
Okay.
And really, this restaurant delivery builds on the infrastructure that they needed for Prime Now. So in order to ship you a good from the warehouse in an hour or two, in order to give you your toilet paper or whatever it is you order, your diapers, they have to have these drivers who are ready to go. And those drivers are the same people who are going to be delivering from restaurants. So Amazon has a situation where they have put this infrastructure in place. They have these drivers that they're contracting with to make deliveries, and they're kind of trying to get the most out of the fact that they have these people on call.
Oh, okay.
So yeah,
but
so,
but it's going to be free for a subscriber to Prime
Now. We should probably go through what who actually can use it. So it's interesting. You have to have the Prime Now app on your phone.
Okay.
Can't order on a desktop as of at least the launch yesterday. So you have to have the Prime Now app, and you have to be a subscriber to Prime, which is the $99 a year service.
Uh-huh.
If you subscribe to Prime, and you're not going to have to pay an extra fee, at least for right now. No word on whether or when that might go away. It was limited time was the way the release read, I believe. So you can log on, scroll through. I think it's 59 restaurants that are available right now. It's 10 zip codes in the city. Amazon says it's going to expand those things. More restaurants, more locations they'll cover. And you can go on, you can order. We're going to be testing it, actually. We have probably right now my colleagues are ordering on OrderUp and Amazon to kind of see which one works. And so we'll get the results of that
very
shortly.
Remind me to ask you about that. Okay. We have to move on real quickly. What's this week's cover story?
This week's cover story is it's a look at Towson and a lot of the work that's being done there, a lot of the construction, new projects. The university is going through a big change. So it's a good read. It's an interesting look at everything that's going on out there in the county.
Great. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
Rick Seltzer of the Baltimore Business Journal. And now I am joined by Annie Howe, who is the owner of Annie Howe Paper Cuts. A paper craft. She crafts incredibly intricate paper cutouts, bicycles, trees, animals. You can check out her work on the Midday Page, or you can see it next weekend in person. And anyhow, how could we see it in person next week? What are we here?
Okay, thanks for having me.
Sure, thanks for being here.
I'm also a member of the Charm City Craft Mafia, and so I'm here to talk about our ninth show, the Holiday Heap, which will happen December 12th.
Holiday Heap.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what is the Holiday Heap?
So it's a craft show that features over 50 vendors from Baltimore and beyond. It happens at 2640 on St. Paul Street. And it's an amazing craft show where basically shoppers can come in and get anything they would want under the sun for the holidays.
Give me some examples.
Okay, so we have vendors selling home goods, soaps, food products, some local favorites, Kinderhook snacks, Gingy chocolates will be there, apparel, kids' goods, artwork, stationery, excuse me. And we even have some really great new vendors this year. There's a local Baltimore company called Childhood Store that makes crayons that are really, really beautiful. And we also have a new vendor called Radica Textiles that's also based...
I'm sorry, I missed the name.
Radica.
Uh-huh.
Radica Textiles. She's based in Baltimore. She makes hand-printed textiles and home goods that are stunning. So a kind of a wide array.
So are there just more craft artists who can make a business these days because of, I don't know, social media or whatnot? I mean, is the craft business changing?
Well, first I want to say that Baltimore shoppers have always been ahead of the curve in terms of supporting local businesses, small crafters. I mean, that's why we're on our ninth show, because the audiences come out. They come out in droves. They know what they want to buy. They're excited about meeting new vendors, about buying from their favorites from the year before. But yes, I think that social media, Instagram, and just the ease of creating an online store has really opened up more opportunities for crafters. For myself, especially on Instagram, I have my local Baltimore audience, but I've been able to expand nationally and internationally just by sharing my work that way.
So... why heap? A holiday heap sounds like a mess. And this, what you've just described, is not a mess.
No, it's not a mess. I can't speak to the name because I was not a member
okay.
when that name was chosen. But just to tell you a little bit more about the event, it's wonderful. We'll have food from the food market. There'll be an incredible raffle that benefits Gather Baltimore that will be stock full of amazing things that our vendors have donated. From 10 to 5, the show is open and free to the public.
Again, that's 10 to 5 next Saturday.
10 to 5, Saturday, December 12th. From 9 to 10, we have an early bird shopping hour. So that is a ticketed event. At this time, I think we only have about 10 tickets left. And
oh
you can buy them ahead of time. And you get sort of early shopping. You get a swag bag filled with treats from our vendors and our amazing sponsors. And it's a great way to kind of have a little more time and room to enjoy all of the products.
And people can find out all about this at the Charm City Craft Mafia website,
yep.
right? I'm looking at www.charmcitycraftmafia.com.
That's perfect, yes.
I really appreciate you telling us about it, Annie.
Thank you. I hope you all come out and shop.
Annie Howe is president of Charm City Craft Media and the owner of Annie Howe Paper Cuts. I want to thank all of our guests today and thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. For locations and hours, visit joesquared.com. And thanks to you for listening. On Monday, we'll continue our series of interviews with Baltimore's 2015 mayoral candidates. We'll be speaking with lawyer Elizabeth Embry. We hope you'll join us. For that, send us your questions for her at midday@wypr.org. And have a great weekend. Stay tuned now for Here and Now, followed by Science Friday. I'll see you Monday.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. Midday's intern is Adam Droneberg. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at wypr.org. or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.